from Portland, Oregon. This is the Jewish Review Podcast. I'm Rockney Roll. Coming up this episode, Passover is almost here. And what's Passover without a Seder? 15 steps, 4 cups of wine, and the foundational story of the Jewish people's journey to freedom. Plus dinner. Preparing a Seder meal can be a delicious task, but also a daunting one. To help make things less daunting and more delicious, I spoke with Noah Jacob, the director of food service for Zupan's Markets in Portland and a luminary of Portland's Jewish food scene. We discussed the traditional fare of the season, some of his personal twists on Passover favorites, and what not to do with leftover matzah. Speaking of unleavened bread, I also took a moment to speak with my colleague, Dr. Yosef Rosen, about making your own matzah and some tips for making the ritual portion of your Seder more meaningful as well as easier. Stay with us. The Jewish Review Podcast is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland and the Jewish Volunteer Corps, presenting Good Deeds Month. The newly launched JVC is hosting a month's worth of volunteer service activities throughout the area. Whatever your passion, there's a Good Deeds Month program for you. Find it online at jewishportland.org/gooddeedsmonth. Let's get started with friend of the podcast and Federation Director of Jewish Life and Learning, Dr. Yosef Rosen. So you recently wrote a piece in the Jewish Review about making your own matzah, and it's a fairly simple task in terms of cooking skills, but there's a really deep spirituality to it. Can you explain why this is such a meaningful experience during this time of year?
Yeah. You know, making matzah is not something I grew up doing, even though I grew up in a very observant home where we celebrated Passover all the time. And I think most Jews today do not make their own matzahs. They buy them, even though for 2,000, 3,000 years, Jews made their own matzah at home, either privately in their home or maybe in a collective communal bakery, for instance. So it's really the invention of machine matzahs, the invention of machines that make matzahs, that really alienated Jews from making their own matzah. And you might say, okay, well, that's a good thing. Who needs to work so hard to make matzah? But as you're saying, there's something really uniquely spiritual, religious, meaningful, if you will, about making your own matzah. After all, one of the reasons that we make matzah, that we eat matzah on Passover, is because the Israelites, when they were leaving Egypt, made matzah. They didn't have time for it to rise. So it wasn't just that they ate matzah, they actually were making it. And the act of making it in haste can remind us that sometimes liberation needs to happen chick-chock. You don't have time for it to be a slow, gradual evolution. You need to leave right now. You need to liberate yourself. So that experience of that return to a home-based, I'm making my own matzah, I think it'd be very empowering for people and help them reconnect to something that might just feel like, oh, this is a stale cracker that I lather some cream cheese and jelly on to make it taste good, rather than this is a meaningful act and I'm not just doing it because, you know, it's a commandment. I'm not just doing it because everyone else did it, but I'm actually making my own handcrafted matzah. And when I'm making it, I'm connecting to that history, to that lineage, both of my ancestors and the original meaning of what it's all about.
Yeah. So the biggest obstacle with that is the flour you use, and usually you're not supposed to have flour this time of year for obvious reasons. Where can you get flour that will work for the ceremonial requirements of Passover or closer to that, perhaps?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, for thousands of years, people would use probably flour that they made themselves. And so let's just back up a second. What's wrong with flour on Passover? After all, flour is not leavened. Mm-hmm. It is not bread. What's wrong with flour? So a couple things. One is like, hey, you don't want to have flour around because it might come into contact with water. And you don't want to mess around on Passover with leavened stuff. But there's a more technical chemistry process in modern industrialization of flour. This was done in earlier times. The Talmud's aware of it as well, but it's certainly prevalent today with white flour, which is that flour is tempered. And what this means is that when the grain, when you want to separate the bran from the grain to get yourself a nice white refined flour, all of the grains, the kernels, are placed in some type of chamber that some type of condensation, some liquid, enters into it, and then it creates a different weight for each of the parts of the bran. Mm-hmm. I don't fully understand the process. But basically what then you get is that the flour came in contact with some level of water. And although clearly it didn't turn it into bread, it still, for some rabbinic perspectives, is a little problematic. And that's why there's this category of shmura flour. We mostly hear about shmura matzah, but really what we're talking about is shmura flour. And shmura means guarded. And this can mean a few things. It can mean that it's guarded from the moment it's harvested, that it never came into water, or from the moment of it being grinding and produced in the factory, in the mill, that it's being made sure that it's not tempered. So luckily today you can get shmura matzah, but until recently you could not get shmura flour. You can get shmura matzah, but if you would go to a bakery that makes shmura matzah and say, hey, can I buy some of your flour? They would say, go away, no way. I can make much more money by using this myself. I'm not going to sell it to you. So luckily there is a new organization called Mitzvot Matzah that is run by a couple or been a couple out of Rhode Island, I believe, that now online you can buy a 5-pound bag of shmura flour. It's a little pricey. It's $60 for 5 pounds, but it's going to be cheaper than buying shmura matzah. And, you know, you only need to make a few. And the reason is that there's really two types of matzah. There's the matzah that we eat at the Seder, and there's the matzah we eat the rest of Passover. It might look the same, but it serves a completely different role. The matzah that you eat 6 days of Passover, there's no obligation to eat it. If you don't want to eat matzah on day 4 of Passover, you're bored of it, that's fine. You're just not supposed to eat any carbohydrate alternatives. So there's no religious value per se, according to most opinions, in eating matzah after the Seder. But matzah at the Seder, that's a mitzvah. That's a ritual. We say a blessing over it. So just to craft your own matzahs for the Seder, that's really meaningful and I think a worthy investment. You don't need to make your own hand matzahs for 8 days of matzah pizza. That's fine. Use the store-bought matzah. So that's one way. The other thing is that you can get other flours in the store that haven't been tempered. Rye and spelt are both grains that it's okay to make matzah out of that have never been tempered. And if they've been tempered, they've been tempered at a very low condensation rate that according to most rabbinic opinions, would be okay. And so really the thing you need to worry about is that when you're making it, you really want to probably make it before Passover. If you're making it on Passover, that's a little precarious because, again, you're making dough and you have to make sure all of that dough got into the oven in time, baked properly. Can be a little bit risky. But if you make it before Passover starts, before your Seder starts, you're probably dealing with something that, with a little foresight, making sure that within 18 minutes of when you finish kneading, everything has been washed, everything's been disposed of, is out of the house. I think it's not that complicated and a worthy experience for people.
Absolutely. So speaking of worthy experiences, you also recently hosted a webinar about hosting your own Seder. Now, we spend a lot of the interview that's going to come after this one talking about how to cook your own Seder, but yours specifically dealt with the ritual aspects. Can you give us the Cliff Notes version, or maybe a teaser for folks who want to watch the recording of that webinar, which is available on our website, some tips for hosting one's own Seder, maybe for the first time.
Yeah. You know, hosting a Seder is a little bit like hosting a Thanksgiving meal, but a lot more. It has that meal component where you need to cook a really nice meal. There's some symbolic foods you're having guests over, but it's not just that. If you thought hosting Thanksgiving was a lot, hosting a Seder is a lot. Not only do you have to make a wonderful meal and some symbolic foods like the maror and providing matzah, but you also need to lead a ritual, right? A Seder can't just be a meal. It's got to be a little bit more. And so what I was trying to offer people is how to make the rest of the Seder beyond the dinner part, which I leave to other more culinary minds to give wisdom for. How do you create a participatory, an interactive, an exciting, tailored Seder? And some of the things I was telling people was the Seder, you know, we already have a script. You don't have to start from scratch. And that's the Haggadah. The Haggadah gives us all of the steps of hosting a Seder. And there's some wonderful Haggadahs. BJ Library has a wonderful Haggadah that you download for free. There's so many exciting Haggadahs. And one thing that I think can be quite fun is recommending to all your guests beforehand to choose their own Haggadah, to source their own Haggadah and bring it with them. And then when you go around the table and you're up to the four questions, you say, hey, does anyone's Haggadah have some cool insights, a cool picture here that they want to share with people? So people are already bringing some resources. And I think that idea of making your guests not just the audience that you now need to perform this whole amazing ritual, it doesn't need to be that way. And it's not really supposed to be that way. Yes, you're hosting it, but it can be like almost like a ritual potluck, if you will, where you're pre-assigning people. Send your guests emails beforehand and say, hey, will you spend 5 minutes looking into the meaning of dipping the vegetable in the salt water and then share a little bit with people about that? Or will you create some fun new ritual that is connected to the maror, the bitter herb, that we can all do to really experience its meaning? And that way you're outsourcing some things, you're making it interactive, you're making it participatory. So those are really kind of the things that I was guiding people through, is not something that we hire a rabbi to come and lead for us. It's probably the most involved Jewish ritual that people do on their own without outsourcing that to any form of Jewish expertise per se. And some people have been hosting seders for years, they know how to do it. But for people who have never done it, that can seem daunting. Hey, who am I to lead a Seder? You know, I'm not a rabbi. I don't have experience with this. Well, you have the Haggadah. You have many wonderful Haggadahs. And make it collaboratory. And understand that the Haggadah can be redesigned anew and again. And go through it beforehand and see what sections you want to keep, what sections you want to amplify, what are some fun ways to add meaning for it. If you have children, for instance, you're not going to want to go through all the sections of the Haggadah. It's going to be too much. Is there a way that you can get your kids to tell the Passover story in a fun, interactive way, where one kid starts the story and then the other kid has to make up a second detail? And all of a sudden, you've told a whole new story that somehow has the same characters and lets the children own the story and make it new for their own time.
A ritual potluck. You took the words right out of my mouth. Dr. Rosen, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much.
A pleasure, Rocky.
You can read more about the history of homemade matzah and how to craft your own in Dr. Rosen's essay in the April 2nd edition of the Jewish Review online at jewishportland.org/Jewish Review. You can also find a recording of Dr. Rosen's How to Host a Seder webinar on the Federation's YouTube page at youtube.com/Jewish Portland. Links to both are in the episode notes. Now let's move on to dinner with Chef Noah Jacob. Chef Noah Jacob, welcome to the Jewish Review podcast. So tell me about your Jewish journey.
I grew up feeling kind of like there wasn't a whole lot of cultural Judaism here, but there was a lot of religious Judaism. I had my bar mitzvah at Neve Shalom and grew up in that community. And then I left and went to college in Montana, where I felt no Jewish community at all. And that was kind of odd, you know. I didn't think it would be odd, but it was, because I didn't feel super connected to my Jewishness at that point. But when I went to college, I definitely missed it. So at that point, I moved to New York, and when I moved to New York and I felt just the overwhelming nature of the Jewish community there, how you show up there and it's just normal to be Jewish. There's so many Jewish people, and there's Jewish restaurants, and there's Jewish cultural things that have nothing to do with religion. It's just food and culture and people.
You don't have to find Jewish community in New York. Jewish community finds you.
It really does. And so I moved there, and I still wasn't like practicing a whole lot, but I lived in the East Village, and I found this Orthodox shul on 6th Street, and it was, if you're familiar with New York, on 6th Street, in the East Village, it's all Indian restaurants, the entire street. But across the street from the Indian restaurants, there's an Orthodox shul, and it's open to the public, and it was the closest one to my house. So I used to go there for all my holidays, and I just liked going and listening to the Hebrew. You know, I didn't understand a whole lot of it, but it just felt more like home. Being around the Jewish deli scene made me want that and miss that kind of like non-religious Jewish community. And ultimately, I met my wife there. We moved to the Bay Area and then moved back here. Her family is Israeli, and they were more observant than I was. And so I've become more observant as an adult. My wife works in the Jewish community, and I've worked in Delhi for a very long time. And so, you know, it's become a very significant part of my life, being, you know, not just the Delhi side, but also the religious side and also just the community aspect of it.
Beyond the Seder plate at a Passover table, what are some of the foods that are associated with a Seder, both traditionally and in more modern times? And how did these foods become tradition?
Well, I think if you look at things like, you know, obviously there's the prescribed items we talked about. There's, you know, the haroset and the maror, things that every table is required to have. But as far as entrees and salads and things like that, I mean, matzo ball soup, obviously, you know, just because there's only a handful of things you can do with matzah, and that's so good, and it's, you know, kind of iconic. But a lot of people use brisket, a lot of people use semis, a lot of people use sort of a bitter green salad to represent bitter greens. There'd be a kale salad maybe or something of the like. Personally, I think of it more as like a springtime meal. So I personally prefer lamb. I like a lot of the Sephardic type recipes, the more Middle Eastern take. Like I said, my wife's family is Israeli, and we all grew up Ashkenazi Jewish. You know, we grew up with this, you know, no rice, no beans. And when at some point that changed and we started to be allowed to have some of these other items, you know, for the Sephardic style of Passover, which made things a lot easier and to me a lot more delicious.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, I think that's kind of my approach on it is Sephardic and springtime. Yeah. And that's how I approach it.
So how did, when we think of the Passover Seder as a springtime meal, how did this, when I think of a Passover Seder, I think of like brisket. How did this heavy, rich dish become so traditional at this festive spring leading into summer meal?
I mean, there's Jewish scholars who are going to know this better than me. But my take is that a lot of Jewish tradition we celebrate in America is Ashkenazi Jewish tradition. And that's where brisket came from. Brisket is a product of our Polish ancestors, you know, and our Eastern European ancestors. I think a lot of the foods that we eat, I would think semis being another one, root vegetables, a lot of the American Jewish traditions are based in that Ashkenazi exodus, you know, from Eastern Europe. But now we don't have to do that. You know, now we don't have to go directly to our roots and eat some of those foods. And so we have the option to look elsewhere.
I think there's a perception that it's hard to cook a good Seder, or at least it's intimidating to cook a good Seder.
Sure.
Where does that come from, and how could that be? How might you apply your culinary expertise to help someone alleviate that intimidation factor?
If you think about making a Thanksgiving meal, and that's a daunting task to make a Thanksgiving meal, and this is kind of like making a Thanksgiving meal, but on top of making the meal, you also have to make all the other things. You have to make, you know, you have to make the menorah, you have to make the rosary, you have to set a Passover table. So there's a lot of things that are required, and then that's before you get to the menu. And I think that's why it's so daunting.
Fair enough.
Because you've got so many things that you have to do. People don't get to stay in their comfort zone and make roast chicken. Well, they can make roast chicken, but they also have to make a lot of other stuff. So
stuff that you don't typically eat at any other point during the year.
Exactly. And you may not know how to make. I think the easiest way to alleviate some of that stress is to buy some of these things. And that was why when I got to Zupan's and after, you know, at Jacob and Sons and Prior, it was so important to me to make these items, the ceremonial items, the chopped liver even, like, and the gefilte fish and the matzo ball soup and all the things that, you know, you have to have. You kind of have to have these things. So to let the people who are at home focus on making the meal, and then maybe you buy the other stuff. We sell all of it. We sell the haroset. We sell the maror. We sell all the aspects, so you could literally walk in the door and buy all these components and go home and have a Seder. I think that's what's so hard about a Seder is that it's not just, oh, I have to make dinner for all these people and I have to have, you know, Haggadah and I have to have someone to lead it and I have to have all of the things. But on top of that, you have to bring in all these other food items that previously, at least in my experience, were hard to find.
Yeah.
Either you had to make them or you had to make them. There wasn't really another way. And now you don't.
And then all of the dietary restrictions of Pesach on top of that.
Of course.
Even more so if you're, you know, strictly observant Ashkenazi and all the fun Sephardic stuff is off the table, literally.
Right. Yeah, literally. But then on top of that, all cleaning out your house. I mean, Passover is, in my house, a very busy time. I mean, April is busy. You know, my in-laws come into town, they stay with us, we clean out the cabinets. I mean, it becomes quite a procedure every year. And it's funny, you know, my wife and I joke around about it. We fought for this holiday. My wife has three siblings, because I'm the chef. We wanted Passover to be our holiday.
Yeah.
And we got it. And now I think we're having 30 people two nights in a row for dinner. You know, kind of like, what did I sign myself up for?
You asked for it.
Exactly.
So since you're hosting 30 people, what is going to be on your, like, maybe this won't be your actual Seder table, but on your idyllic, in a perfect world Seder table, what are you serving?
Well, so I do two different dinners for two different nights because I just can't eat the same thing two nights in a row, even though the guests are different. So the first night we'll do super traditional Ashkenazi because that's what my in-laws are used to, and that's what, you know, a lot of our family friends are used to. So it'll be the brisket, and it'll be, we make schnitzel. We do it with matzah meal because that's just for the kids to have some version of fried chicken.
Yeah.
It lasts all week, you know? So that's our standard. We'll do a bitter green salad. We'll do matzo ball soup. We'll do chopped liver. We'll do, my mother-in-law makes a really incredible fake chopped liver, which we actually sell now at the store, which is a pretty cool thing to be able to take a recipe that was a family recipe and have it produced so that other people can buy it, you know?
If it's not actually chopped liver, what is it?
It is hard-boiled eggs, caramelized onions, and walnuts. And it's vegetarian. It's delicious. It kind of mimics the flavor and texture of chopped liver. But I'd never seen it before going to my in-law's house for Passover, and I thought it was so good. And then now having the opportunity to be able to just, take these recipes that nobody had but us and now put them out to the audience. It's really cool.
The fun of chefing.
Exactly.
So if you're making brisket, what's your brisket recipe?
Oh, it depends on if it's my mother's recipe or if it's my recipe. My recipe typically involves Coca-Cola. I use Coca-Cola base. I use vinegar. It's a sweet and sour, kind of a sweet and sour sauce, some chili sauce, and some ketchup. Cook it for a really long time. Pull it out, chill it, slice it, put it back in with the sauce, and then roast it with some pearl onions and some carrots.
That sounds perfect.
Yeah.
I'm getting hungry.
Yeah.
All right. So for someone who's cooking their first Seder and like we said, is maybe a little overwhelmed, but doesn't want to fully go the route of, and this is an available option, of course, to call Zupan's or one of our other local retailers, like, I need Passover dinner. For someone who's in that situation, what are some ideas that might help make this a little bit easier or at least a little bit easier to approach mentally?
Well, assuming you're having other people for dinner, I think Passover really should be a potluck. I mean, Passover should be someone brings the maror, someone brings the haroset, someone brings all the Seder plate. You should really not feel bad about farming out some of this stuff to your friends, because if it's your job to make the dinner, and I assume that for most people, the easiest thing to do is some sort of a roasted chicken or a chicken morbello like we do at Zupan's. A roasted chicken, a salad, that's really all you need because you had a lot of things before that. Mm-hmm. You've got, like I said, all the matzo ball soup and the chopped liver and the gefilte fish and all those things leading up to it. So I would employ my friends to help me, especially when it comes to haroset, which I think is so cool that there's hundreds of different recipes. And when you ask someone to make it for you, you never know what you're going to get. It could have raisins in it. It could have dried fruit in it. It could have anything. I mean, my version, the one we sell, is very basic. It's apples and walnuts and wine and some seasoning. But I've had so many different kinds of haroset, so I think it's cool to open it up to the audience and say, what do you want to bring? Bring me something. Bring me a salad.
What's community for if not helping you cook?
Exactly. Especially for something like this where it's so participatory. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're already participating, going around the tables, reading passages and talking and singing. I mean, if you're going to contribute in that way, you might as well bring some food.
And in terms of cooking a main dish, nothing wrong with a chicken.
Yeah,
most
absolutely.
People know how to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a roast chicken is the standard. That's the easiest way to do it for me.
What's the secret to the easiest roast chicken? Or is there a secret?
I mean, the secret is 425 or 1 hour. That is the secret. Every time people ask, what's the secret? It's so good. It's like, no, we spatchcock a chicken. It can anything you want on it, but it's 1 hour, 425, always.
All right. I'm writing this down. Yeah. Spatchcock, 425, 1 hour.
Yeah.
It's going to burn into my brain.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the other side of the equation for somebody who's maybe done this a few times. They've got Bubby's recipe down solid, but they want to try something new. They want to spice it up a little bit.
Yeah.
What are some ideas from your culinary genius?
There are so many fun things you can do. You can do some really cool leg of lamb recipes, like the Otto Lange books have some pretty incredible ones. You can do things like, if you want to go more Ashkenazi, you can make your own pastrami. You can cure and smoke your own, brisket if you want to. It's super cool. There's just a lot of ways you can go. I think there's some really amazing rack of lamb recipes I would mm-hmm. also do. There's a million salads, a million really cool. If you look up bitter green salad on Google, there's hundreds of them and some really cool ones that are all very seasonal, things that utilize pomegranate seeds, which I think are kind of appropriate for the holiday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's just a lot of ways to incorporate little details from the Seder, whether it be hard-boiled eggs or whether it be onions or whether it be matzah. You can do a fattoush salad with matzah instead of pitas. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can take it and make it ethnic, and I think that's really where it gets elevated. If you take it and make it Sephardic, make it Middle East, or make it, with recipes that are a little more elevated, just happened to fit the role,
And you can bring those Sephardic flavor influences even if you were sticking to Ashkenazi rules for...
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's just a matter of bringing in some cinnamon and some allspice and a little bit of maybe Ras al Hanout or some baharats, Israeli seasoning. Just, going the more Israeli route, I think really brightens it up a little bit, as opposed to all those boiled potatoes and boiled meats,
all those reminders of Eastern Europe.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just shtetl food, you know?
So when we're talking about doing a rack of lamb, I'm not familiar with cooking lamb, and I imagine a lot of other people might not be. Mm-hmm. What are the kind of flavor profiles that work well with lamb?
There's a couple that I use, three in particular, I'd say. The classic, my grandparents, mint jelly. So a mint version, right? Mm-hmm. That's like for, I don't want to say old people, but like the Altcockers, that's like, you know, lamb and mint. There's the more modern version of it, which, you know, there's a New York Times recipe. Actually, we called it at Jacob & Sons. It's Florence's Rack of Lamb. It's my grandmother's recipe, but actually turned out it was a New York Times recipe from the 50s. Marjoram and ginger are the two leading flavors in that. And I think marjoram, soy sauce, and ginger together make incredible lamb. It's kind of neutral. It's not like a country. It's just really, really good. And then when it gets to the more Middle Eastern side, it's the shawarma flavors you're looking for. You know, it's that cumin and that cinnamon and the Middle Eastern flavors. I think that always goes well with lamb and dried fruit.
Yeah. You know, you're not alone when it turns out the family recipe is from a cookbook somewhere.
Yeah.
I loved my father's beef stew recipe for a long time until, and I still love it, but it was a little shocking when I found it in Better Homes and Gardens.
Right, right. I was shocked too.
This is the way things go. Yeah. So a Seder is not a Seder without matzah, almost
right.
By definition.
Yeah.
But having matzah at a Seder usually means leftover matzah. What do you do with leftover matzah? What are your favorite things to do with leftover matzah?
If not always, right? First, let me say, I just met with a really cool vendor. One of the cool parts about my job here is I get to meet all these local businesses mm-hmm. in Portland and see what they're making. And I met with a new baker here, not new, they've been around 10 years, I didn't know them, called Bake Shop. And they make incredible pastries, but they're making their own matzah this year. Like really beautiful matzah. I've never seen anyone in Portland, at least, even trying to make their own matzah. So I think this is super cool that I'm even seeing this out there.
Yeah.
In my family, it's matzah brei next day. We're always making matzah brei. If you're not familiar with matzah brei, scrambled eggs with matzah, right? You soak the matzah for a few seconds in some water. I make more like mine more like a quiche where I add some cream to it and let it put it in a pan and then put it in the oven and let it puff up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the easiest one. But then something like matzah pizza people love, and it can be really good. I've had it really good. I've had matzah lasagna that's been really good. And, you know, my horrible memories of my childhood with matzah, going to school with peanut butter and honey sandwiches on matzah to school in a plastic bag and arriving and it's just in crumbles, you know? So you can find ways to use matzah all week.
Some of which may be more or less reminiscent of the term the bread of affliction.
That's exactly right. I mean, I certainly didn't feel like blessed to be carrying a peanut butter and honey matzah sandwich to school, in high school.
Especially like when you get to actual lunchtime and it no longer has the consistency
of
a sandwich.
No, it's crushed and disgusting.
On the other hand, we mentioned matzah pizza. I think that, thinking about that, that might be the secret weapon to help a kid get through
absolutely
a more traditional Seder service that's
totally
multiple hours long.
I would also say that the schnitzel, I mean, we do just chicken breasts with, you know, egg wash and then matzo meal seasoning, and kids will eat that. It is chicken nuggets, basically, and it's delicious.
Heck, I'm 38 and I'd eat that.
Right?
This is the problem when I do food-themed podcasts. I end up hungry by
I'll
the
bet.
End. So we talked a little bit earlier in the episode about things you can do with haroset and bitter herbs. So I want to dig more into ways you can make the Seder plate itself have a little more culinary pizzazz.
Okay. Well, the first thing I'll say is we added a few years ago, and I'm sure there's going to be people out there who tell me this is incorrect, but we added an orange to our Seder plate maybe 4 years ago, which now, after doing some research, I believe for us, it represents all underrepresented people, essentially. So women didn't have a place in the, you know, in the Seder plate.
Yeah.
Now they do. So we add an orange to it. But as far as what else you can do, you know, we make our own horseradish. We grow horseradish root and then we like grind it up. We pickle beets and mix it with the horseradish. I mean, if you make it from scratch, it's going to be much better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially with something like maror, which, I mean, when we were at Jacob & Sons, I made, I want to say, 50 quarts of maror 1 year. And 50 quarts of horseradish is a lot. I mean, that is a really rough day in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it with pickled beets, where we actually, you know, roast and then pickle the beets with a kind of what I call winter spice. So it's got cinnamon and allspice and black pepper and bay leaf. And then we use that and the pickling liquid to make the maror. So that's like a pretty high-end maror. That's like a, you know, to me, it's a nuanced flavor. It's not just blast you with horseradish. It has some other flavor profile to it also. Haroset is fabulous. There's I mean, like I said, there's so many recipes. And when we, again, back at Jacob and Sons, people brought us maror, and they brought their own versions of maror to visit us. They would pick up huge orders, and then they would bring us, oh, you should try my daughter's maror or whatever. Haroset. And I had ones that were like in little balls, like truffles. Like it's, you know, essentially dried fruit that's been blended with nuts and then rolled in cinnamon into like essentially little truffles. And that was, you know, a version, I think Yemeni version of Haroset. There's just so many different versions of it. And I mean, I think they're all really, really good and really interesting. And then, you know, we also, in my family, I don't know if this is traditional, it may be, but we mix the Haroset with the maror and then make a little sandwich out of it.
Yeah. I have seen that done in other seders, so yeah. It's not just you.
Yeah, I figured it wasn't. I don't think we made it up. But yeah, I think that's delicious too.
Speaking of dried fruit, we were talking a little earlier off air about Tzimis usually being a pretty Ashkenazi and from that Ashkenazi tradition being kind of heavy and mm-hmm. wintry, and that some dried fruit could be a way to lighten that up and give it a little more
Well, so Tzimis typically has dried fruit. It mm-hmm. usually has apricots and prunes because those will be actually available in Eastern Europe. But you definitely can mix it up with some tart cherries or, you know, a bunch of interesting dried fruit. You can even go more tropical with it. I've seen that done where you do like pineapple. And then I like to add, like I said, I make a sesame coriander crumble. So I toast off coriander seeds and then crack them and grind them and then mix them with some honey and some sesame seeds and toasted and a little bit of salt. And it's delicious. And it adds a little bit of crunch to a dish that can be a little
mushy.
Yeah, I guess that's the word, right? Mushy, dense, roasted root vegetables with dried fruit and orange juice, but trying to add some other flavors to it that kind of brighten it just a touch.
I can imagine those tropical flavors would be fun for folks having a Seder here in Portland where yeah. Passover weather is usually pretty drippy and cold.
Right, absolutely. And I think that that's the thing with Portland is you can kind of do anything here. You know, people here in Portland eat brisket for every holiday, for every Jewish holiday. Mm-hmm. I've seen people eat latkes for Rosh Hashanah here. You know, I mean, it's just Jewish food in Portland is Jewish food, it seems like. That's my take. I'm sure someone will disagree with me. But we go to New York, you go to L.A. or a larger Jewish community, it's much more prescribed. You know, it's you don't eat brisket at the break fast after Yom Kippur. You know, my family, we have brisket for breakfast, you know. But, you know, in more observant families in Eastern, you know, East Coast or in L.A., it's all dairy. In Portland, we kind of didn't have to worry about any of that stuff growing up. It wasn't so prescribed. You could just kind of do whatever you wanted to do. And so people just brought all of their Jewish traditions all together in this big mishmash and kind of just put it together and said, this is a Jewish dinner. We have brisket. We have all these things. Which I think is fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention brisket done well is really good.
Absolutely. And I think our brisket here is really, really good. I mean, it's as close to homemade as I've ever had. And that was when I was doing the food here at Zupan's. You know, there's always this push here, but also in restaurants, to make things fancier, to make them more elevated. Mm-hmm. And I make a deliberate effort with these foods to not do that too much, to kind of make them more home style, to make them taste like your grandmother made them. Because I think that's what people are really looking for these holidays. If you've got a person who's a home chef and they want to elevate their Passover Seder, there's some great ways to do that.
Yeah.
But for most people, what they're looking for when they buy this food, I find, they just want something that tastes like it was homemade. And they want it to be super familiar. You know, remind them of their childhood, remind them of their grandparents. And so when we're writing the recipes, I'm not really looking to elevate them too much. I want to add a little twist, you know. But yeah. I want them to taste like home, and that's kind of the point.
Something your grandmother, your bubby might cook if she was just that tiniest bit better of a cook.
Right, exactly.
And we'd never yeah. say that to her face.
Of course not. Although I've never, ever heard that my matzo ball soup is better than anyone's grandmother's, ever. So, like, it's always not as good.
That's because everybody feels like their grandmother is listening.
And they are, probably.
So, one last question about brisket. If I've been told correctly, the secret... One of the secrets to make sure it's good, probably the pivotal secret to make sure it's good, is to cook it long enough. And it's...
Yeah. Well, I think it's both, right? You have to cook it long enough so that it cooks through, but then you have to cook it not so far that it falls apart. Mm-hmm. Because once it's cooked, then you have to chill it, remove it, slice it, and then cook it again. So, I mean, it's kind of a touchy thing. You know, if you're not used to cooking brisket, you know, it's you can say, oh, put it in for an hour and a half or whatever, but... That's never going to be right. You have to be able to touch it and feel it and make sure that it's where it's supposed
to
be.
And temperature won't tell you. No. It's by feel.
Yeah, it's all by feel. I mean, these recipes are all by feel. You know, I've been training staff, non-Jewish staff, to make Jewish food is really funny. Because like when it came to like the chopped liver, for example, I'm dealing with all these French trained chefs. This is not here, but elsewhere. And they were like, well, you have to blend it with butter. You have to make it smooth. You have to make it like pate. It's chopped liver. No, no, no. My Jewish audience kept saying, make it worse. Make it worse. Make it chunkier. Grind it rougher. Add less fat. Make it taste more like liver. You know, like, you know, so trying to tell people, no, make it worse. Make it like your grandmother made it. Boil it in a pot. You know, don't sous vide it. Don't try to make it fancy. Just make it like, you know, with if you had one oven and that's it. That's all you had.
Well, speaking of grandmother's kitchen, potentially, what are some of your favorite memories of this time of year, either growing up or more recently? Yeah. It could be at the Seder table. It could be elsewhere. It sounds like peanut butter matzah sandwiches the next day is not a favorite memory.
Not my favorite memory. I grew up here with a really tight-knit Jewish community of about five families, and we did Seder every year, and I still see them all the time. Just family friends who just, you know, we just did a very traditional Seder at our friends at Zakheim's house every year. Then I went away, and I stopped celebrating for a long time. I mean, I really, for God, I want to say 7-8 years, I didn't really celebrate Jewish holidays, really. I just was kind of trying to find my relationship with Judaism. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I met my wife and her family that I really understood how cool Passover was, so how much I really embraced it, because it just brings together so many of my favorite things, you know, with between the singing and the food and all the, you know, that it's just such a fantastic holiday, I think. And so when I met my wife's family, they do the world's best Seder. I mean, I was just blown away. And I say, I'm going to do 30 people this year. I'm going to do, I think it's 28 and 29, two nights. That would be like normal every day for them. Like they just always had a huge group of people. They were used to, and they were doing kosher too. They had a kosher Seder every year, 30 people in their house in California. And they would lead. My father-in-law, Effie, leads it. He's incredible. He knows all of it. He speaks Hebrew and does a lot of Talmud and Torah study. He knows all the stories behind it.
So he's standing up at the head of the table and he's barely got to look at the Haggadah. He's just got it down.
I mean, he probably doesn't have to look at this point. For sure, actually. And then his wife, Shira, she had done all the baking and she created these incredible baking recipes that we now use. In fact, we sold them at Jacob & Sons, her recipes. We sold off the bakery to Henry Higgins. Henry Higgins now uses those recipes. And some of this, the best, you know, we grew up with Passover desserts being kind of like meh, mm-hmm. kind of heavy and taste like matzah. Her Passover desserts were the first time I ever was like, wow, these are Passover or not. These are delicious. So I just, you know, it was cool to see this, like, this relationship between two of them. They both have their roles. They come in and they do their thing. You know, she does the cleaning and the cooking, and he does all of the religious part of it. And the Seder was amazing. At the end of it, they would do half an hour of just singing. People would bring out guitars, and they had all these songs they would do. And I just was so overwhelmed by it that I started bringing my family to it. And then my family got very used to it, and they loved it. And so they were very excited when I moved it up to Portland, you know, during COVID. And now we try to recreate it.
Nice. I guess that's something you mentioned, the Seder dessert, that I think that's something that goes unmentioned or unthought about, because, you know, usually people are very full after a Seder. So it's that is impressive that you can put together a dessert that doesn't just taste like rehashed matzah,
right,
that you want to eat after you've been loading up on everything for multiple hours.
I remember distinctly the first couple of years going to my in-law's house, and my mother-in-law would have been cooking, baking for days in preparation for this, and she's making macaroons. She's making meringues with chocolate inside of them. She's making little almond thumbprint cookies with raspberry in them. Just huge quantities, just on every table, just cookies everywhere. And as we were getting ready for Passover, just snacking on all these little cookies, you know? And she's like, no, no, don't eat those. Those are for later. My father-in-law doesn't really love food. Like, he loves bread, but he doesn't love food. He loves sweets, and he loves chocolate. And so for him, the highlight of the meal was the desserts. You know, the rest of it, it's okay. But the highlight was desserts. So the desserts had to be top-notch. And, I mean, I was just blown away by how good these were and how they don't taste like Passover. It's just, they just happen to be for Passover, right? Like, mm-hmm. a meringue is not necessarily just for Passover. It could be whatever, but they happen to work for Passover. And anything with almond flour just works for Passover. We use almost no matzo meal or matzo flour in any of our Passover desserts. Because who wants more matzah if you can avoid it, you know?
There's plenty of time for that in the days after the Seder.
Plenty. Yeah. We'll make so many cookies that we'll have them all week, and we'll just have cabinets full of them.
Well, talking about all these cookies, I'm going to have to go get some now myself. So yes. Hug Sameya to you and yours. Noah Jacob, thank you so much for joining us in the Jewish Review Podcast.
It's been such a pleasure, Rocky. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
That's all for this episode of the Jewish Review Podcast. An enormous thank you to Chef Noah Jacob and Dr. Yosef Rosen for sharing their considerable expertise and their joy in the Passover season. If you're looking for more resources to cook your own Seder or to have somebody else do it for you, check out our piece on Portland's Passover food options in the April 2nd edition of the Jewish Review online at jewishportland.org/Jewish Review. If you like this episode, please leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice to help others find our show. Click subscribe to get our latest episode every 2 weeks, and tell a friend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out by email to editor@jewishportland.org. Don't forget, you can get the latest news from Portland's Jewish community by subscribing to The Jewish Review online for free at jewishportland.org/Jewish Review. The Jewish Review Podcast is a production of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Our associate editor is Karone Blau-Rothstein. Assistant editor is Rachel Nelson. Special thanks to Daniel Berger. Our theme music is by Isaac Joel. I'm Rockney Roll. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, Chag Pesach Sameach, Happy Passover, and all the best.